pass, you know, most of our units are maybe 2 hours, 3 hours maximally. But the hematology unit, which includes lymph nodes and things of that sort, bleeding disorders, is considerably different. So I'm going to be with you for a while. On Thursday, we'll start class an hour late, as you probably know. We will be in here at 9 o'clock for this class. Is that right? 9 to 11 for me. So see if I can remember it by then. Generally, I come in, I make some big announcement like that the day before, and then I show up at 8 o'clock anyway. But so if you see me loitering about out there, shoo me off at 8 o'clock. I'll come back at 9. That's when we'll start. What I'm going to be doing today, we'll be dealing with the red blood cell disorders. We're looking at where hematopoietic tissue exists in the body, and the sort of some of the, very cursory the maturation. Let's see if I can get this thing to come on, come back. Keeps wanting to tell me it doesn't particularly care for the screen resolution. We're going to be looking at where hematopoietic tissue lives and what you know, some measures of how effective it is. Is it producing the elements that we want? When we use the term formed elements, which I will use, we're basically talking about the cellular elements of the blood. And as you know, blood is about 60% for most of us. It's about 55 to 60% water, some proteins, and the cellular elements represent about half or a little bit less than half of when we talk what blood is. And we're going to be talking about those sorts of things. So, hematopoietic tissue, red blood cell disorders is what we're going to be starting off with. When we take a look, an interesting thing is that, of course, in the adult, as I'm sure you're aware, the bone marrow is the space where red blood cell and white blood cells and platelets and so forth are made, where the hematopoietic tissue is. It wasn't always so, because at least in utero, there are no formed bones yet, or the bones have cartilage models and are coming along, so you don't have that. And so if we take a look at very early phases of development in utero, and you still have to have blood, of course. I mean, you got to have red blood cells and all that sort of stuff. So that's being manufactured in hematopoietic tissue, precursor cells, that live essentially in what's called the yolk sac, which is kind of going to become sort of part of the abdominal wall, abdominal cavity, and the retroperitoneal fat. Later, it moves into the liver and the spleen, and then by the time you actually have bones, it relocates itself into the bone marrow space just a little bit before birth, and then that's pretty much where it stays. In children, the bone marrow activity goes on in all bones of the body. In adults, it is basically stewed down to what we call the axial skeleton. If you were to take a look at our bones of the legs, the long bones of the legs and arms, there's very little hematopoietic tissue there in adults, but there's quite a bit there in children because it needs all the bone marrow space. The thing about this is that if something should happen to the bone marrow space later in life, or we should have extraordinary need for formed elements, we'll actually see in an adult the liver and spleen becoming a site once again of bone marrow activity if the need is extreme. Generally speaking, we see that when things have occurred that cause bone marrow to scar away and the bone marrow space disappears, and then we'll see what's called extramedullary hematopoiesis. The extramedullary mean it goes out of the bone and it goes back into places and begins to work in places where it had been in utero. That really cannot meet the need. There just simply isn't enough room there for it all to happen. That's what the body tries to do, but still people will have symptoms and issues related to decreased white blood cell and red cell production when there's something wrong with the bone marrow space. But at least hematopoietic tissue has a place to go to. If it can possibly do it, it will. And so here is what we see with development in terms of children and adults, and that is that hematopoietic tissue in kids occupies, found probably in just about every bone. In the case of adults, most of it is in what we call the axial skeleton here, as opposed to the appendicular, the appendage skeleton. And the unfortunate aspect of that is that if there are chest or abdominal malignancies and we end up using beam radiation to try and take care of that, we're going to cook areas of the body that are really instrumental in producing hematopoietic, at least finished product, red cells and so forth, So we lose that, but also those guys are rapidly developing. As you know, we're constantly turning those over. And one of the things that may occur as a consequence of that would be a malignancy of bone marrow origin. So we're going to talk about leukemias later, that sort of thing. But where we have, it's amazing it doesn't occur more often the way I think about it. You know, your white blood cells, depending on the species of white blood cells, may only last a few hours. You constantly make granulocytes. I mean, the average lifespan when it's got nothing to do is only about 2 days. If you have an infection going on, you're making those granulocytes at a clip of they're lasting only maybe 20, 30 minutes. And so you're constantly making them from, you know, progenitor cells. So anything that's dividing rapidly like that in the bone marrow is sort of at risk for toxic agents or ionizing radiation and that sort of business. Well, this is kind of what the deal is then. When we talk about the formed elements, we're going to be considering this and fundamentally, in broad strokes, in a way, that there is a pluripotential cell that's in the bone marrow. And when we take a look at it in the bone marrow, it actually looks a lot like a lymphocyte. It's very hard to distinguish it just when the pathologist sees a bone marrow sample to make the distinction between the stem cell and a lymphocyte. That's what it looks like. That pluripotential cell, depending on stimulus to it, it's going to either go down the lymphocyte line, it's going to mature and begin producing cells down the lymphocyte line, or it's going to do down what we call the trilineage line. And we're going to be focusing on this trilineage line right now. And that is to say granulocytes, red blood cell precursors, and megakaryocytes that produce platelets. Now, this diagram shows something, and there's a stripe of a different color here. It's showing something interesting. In order to be able to produce the number of cells that we need, you can't just have one pluripotential cell decide, okay, I'm going to become and go down the trilineage line, and I've decided I'm going to become a red blood cell. Okay, so wherever they are, okay, I'm up here, I'm going to do this. And that one cell goes here, and that one cell finishes, and when you're done, you have one red blood cell. That ain't going to happen. You will never be able to produce enough red blood cells to live on. So what this diagram is showing is that in this area of it right here, all of these cells have capability of dividing and giving rise to more cells at that level of maturation. And if we didn't have that capability, we could never generate enough cells, enough granulocytes, enough red cells, enough platelets, or anything to keep us all cooking. So again, maturation continues, but also divisions continue up to a point. When we get to this point here, things are pretty well fixed and those cells do not divide again. What that means is that cells that are in this area here that are undergoing division and DNA replication are again at risk for mutations and so forth that could give rise to a malignancy or something that would have a sort of a characteristic appearance that the cell got this far and went no further. And at that point something went wrong with it and it began to clonally proliferate itself at that level of maturation and never finished the project. So at any rate, the way it works is that we have one cell that divides and this says, I'm going to go to a trilineage line. That cell now gives rise to thousands of its own kind, exactly at that level of maturation. Some of them are going to go down here. That cell right there that's committed in the red cell line is going to give rise to thousands of its own kind as it is maturing, as they're all walking together to eventually become a mature red cell. So that's an important thing to know here, that the way in which we are capable of making the number of cells that we need is that they all have the ability to divide up to a certain point, then they're fixed, and then after that there is no further replication of that. There's only maturation, the completion to the finished product. So when we take a look at tumors and so forth, malignancies arising in the bone marrow, that's an important thing to go back to, is that some of those cells, even though they're kind of in various stages of maturation, are capable of dividing, giving rise to their own kind. This is a section of bone marrow, and this right here is a bone spicule, and the bone marrow space is full of bone marrow. You see a lot of white spots in there. In the healthy condition, bone marrow is about where you have active hematopoiesis, where we expect to find that going on. Bone marrow is about 50% fat and 50% hematopoietic tissue, and the white openings here are fat cells. In the case of making the sections of this processing of the tissue, it goes through xylene as one of the steps, and xylene takes out all the lipids. And so fat cells, which had fat in them, the fat was dissolved and taken out during the tissue processing while we were making the section put on the slide so we could see it. So they appear as voids or holes. But at any rate, you can see it's roughly 50-50. And that is the mixture of healthy. So if we were to see that overrun, where it's 100% cellular, it could mean one of a couple of things. One is that we got a problem downstream with consumption or greater need for product, and the cells are being kicked out in greater quantity. Or that we have some kind of runaway proliferative problem in here, and something that may potentially be malignant. So that's the first thing we do is we kind of say, yeah, we see everything that's there, but does it occur in the proper overall ratio? Now, Grant, with these lights, I don't know if we can turn those out. Maybe we'll all go to sleep if we do that. But if you take a look at the bone marrow itself, you will see lots and lots of cells in different stages of maturation. And it's really tricky for a pathologist, somebody who even spends most of their life looking at that, to actually identify and say these cells, this particular cell is at this particular level of maturation. It does become important, though, when we're taking a look at abnormal growth, abnormal proliferation of a particular line or particular lineage of the cells. Okay, now, I'm going to go back to the asteroid bodies there. So the production, here's where the production is. I'm kind of following along in my notes here. Some of the things that we do, how are we going to assess bone marrow function? And of course, the easy thing is we're going to be taking a look at the end product. What are you making? Are you successfully making red blood cells? Are you keeping up with the need? Are you successfully making inflammatory cells and so on? And in the situation with red blood cells, and we're going to be talking first about anemias here, an important consideration that we can see in the peripheral blood, so it's pretty uncommon to go get a bone marrow sample. Very uncomfortable to do that. We don't put the knock the person out for it. It's kind of like a trip to the dentist's office. So that's what I used to tell them. But it hurts. It hurts for a few seconds when we take that sample and we suck that sucker up into a syringe. Got to drill a hole into the bone. And we can numb up practically everything, but we can't numb up the interior of the bone. So when we get the sample for a split second, it's quite uncomfortable. We don't do that. We don't need to do that. You see, if we take a look at the peripheral blood, we'll take a look at some of the things that we look for in the red blood cells. But one of the important factors is, since red blood cells last for a long time, how long do they generally last in us? What's the expected lifespan? Yeah, about 3 months, 4 months, somewhere in that range, 120 days, somewhere out there like that. So they last a long time. So if you stop making red blood cells today, it would be a few weeks or maybe even a month or so before you really were kind of running out of gas. Of course, at the end of 120 days, you'd be in serious trouble. But we can actually look at something. In the peripheral blood, we can say how many really brand new young red blood cells just got into the picture. How many are out there? Now, when red blood cells are being manufactured and they're growing, you know, they're obviously producing lots and lots of hemoglobin. And so the precursor cells in the bone marrow have a lot of RNA in them, and they're busy making lots and lots of hemoglobin. And for about the first 3 to 4 days of a red blood cell's life out in the circulating blood, it continues making hemoglobin. And what we can look for then is the amount of RNA. After about 3 days, 4 days, the RNA is digested, it's gone. The red cell, of course, has no nucleus anyway at this point. But if we take a look at the number of red blood cells that are RNA rich, Gesundheit, that are very RNA rich, we can say those are brand new. Those are young cells that just came out of the bone marrow. And we know that you have to be able to produce about 2-3% of, you're replacing on every single day, you're replacing around 2% of your red blood cells, something like that. And so if we take a look at that, we can see how many red blood cells, brand new red blood cells, came into the circulation by simply doing a stain for RNA, and that's known as a reticulocyte. And we're doing a reticulocyte count. And we express that in terms of percentage of red blood cells that are out there. And so if we see somebody who just isn't making any retics at all, we know that their bone marrow is not healthy, and they're not able to add new red blood cells at a clip that will keep you have enough red cells around. On the other hand, if we see an extraordinary number, if it's very high, it might mean that red blood cells have a very short lifespan and that they're being destroyed for some reason or lost. You're bleeding them out someplace, or that there's an autoimmune process where you're destroying the red cells and the bone marrow has kicked it into real high gear and it's now putting out 6 or 7% new red cells every day, because that's what it takes to maintain what, where you have to be. So the reticulocyte count is a very important thing. As I say, bone marrows are unusual. We'll talk about certain chemistry values that we can look for, and obviously vitamin levels and iron level and so on. But in terms of what's most important will be history and physical. And you're going to see people, I guarantee you, who have very pale conjunctiva. You'll see people who are anemic. And it may be a surprise to them. They say, well, yeah, I haven't been able to, I don't have any juice left, you know. I'm going to sleep at the middle of the afternoon and so forth. Pale skin, but pale conjunctiva, pale mucous membranes. And they're anemic. And the anemia could be for a variety of reasons. It could be because the bone marrow has just crapped out or because there's a nutritional deficiency. But be aware of this, because you may be the person who makes that and say, you know, you need to get that looked into, kind of thing. So history and physical is ultimately what's most important in terms of establishing what potentially is the underlying cause. What's the first domino that's come down, and now what it is, how it's manifesting itself is inadequate numbers of red blood cells in the circulating blood. Okay, these happen to be red blood cell precursors, and if you've not looked at a lot of these, you'd be quite surprised. You say, well, this is awfully blue. Red blood cells are supposed to be nice and pink staining with the stains that we use because they're very protein rich, and that's true, the finished product. But getting there is a different story. This is a very early precursor of a red cell right here, and the cytoplasm is intensely blue because it's so RNA rich. It's made so much RNA for the hemoglobin, it's so loaded with that, and you'll see as it goes through the maturational sequence that the cytoplasm becomes more and more pink staining as it develops more and more protein, more and more hemoglobin, and that basically becomes the primary staining quality of it. Eventually it's going to stop, it's going to get rid of the nucleus, and then it's going to stop making hemoglobin and go about its job. This is an EM picture of a nucleus being expelled, and you can actually see some nuclear debris out here, and of course that's going to get recycled too. We're going to break that down and reuse to some extent nucleotides that are in there, recycle them. Unfortunately, in some cases, making uric acid. Here's an example of maturational sequence of myeloid cells. In other words, the granulocytes, neutrophils and the like. Up here, by the way, is a bare nucleus. That is a nucleus from a red blood cell right there. But at any rate, this shows some of the maturation of cells from that, again, that precursor. And these guys had chosen to go not only down the trilineage line, the original, the granddaddy cell in this whole thing, decided it was going to go down the line to make granulocytes. And all of these have capability of dividing up to probably about this stage right here. But all of these guys have the capability to clone themselves at that stage of maturation, and then all its daughter or son cells move on and mature from that level on. Otherwise, we'd never be able to create the number of granulocytes that we need. So they have to be able to clone themselves as they also walk down the maturational line. They can do that up to a point. This is a megakaryocyte. Megakaryocytes are the ones that produce the platelets. They have a lot of nuclear material in here. In fact, this right here, when we use the term N2, when I say that most of my cells in my body are N2, what am I talking about here? How many copies of the chromosome I have? I have two copies of the chromosomes, right? Except for my sex chromosomes, I have one X and one Y. But I'm 2N in all of my cells. This guy right here is about 64N. This thing makes new DNA, but it doesn't actually go through a cellular division. And these become quite giant cells, huge cells by comparison. That's why we call them megakaryocytes. They're great big guys. So the nucleus is quite large, contains all of the DNA for what it would have been about 8 divisions, and is busy sort of fragmenting the cytoplasm off to create the platelets that are going to be in the circulating blood, kind of our first line of defense against hemorrhage and so forth. All right, let's go on specifically now and take a look at anemias. And when we think about the anemia, I mean, technically speaking, I guess it's a hypoemia. If it's an anemia, you ain't got no emias. You know, you haven't got any red cells. And that's a really serious development. We use the term anemia, but it really is hypoemia. We really have decreased numbers of red blood cells decreased oxygen carrying capacity. Ultimately, it's the lack of hemoglobin in the circulating blood that's going to, obviously contained in the red cells, that's going to produce the symptoms here. The first thing I would just like to emphasize is that anemia is not a disease in itself. Well, there are some. Sickle cell disease, G6PD deficiency, those there really is, that is a disease, that's a process, it's a genetic thing. But anemia, by and large, is a reflection of something else that's wrong. If someone just had a low red blood cell count, that doesn't necessarily tell us much. We have to go find out why. And that is the underlying cause. So I say that it rarely is anemia a disease in and of itself. It's a manifestation of either bone marrow failure or a manifestation of decreased intake of iron or B12 or something like that. So it's a symptom, effectively. Not unlike a fever or a cough or something like that. It's just a symptom, and you've got to figure out what the heck's going on. So there is an underlying cause, and that is what really has to be discovered and corrected. So, and I'm sure I must have meant something really brilliant by unpredicted outcomes, but I'm dying if I remember that now. So, we make also a distinction here between what we call acute and chronic anemias. And acute anemia really just fits into a couple of categories, and that would be very rapid loss of red cells, which either means, for some reason, catastrophic destruction within the vascular system or loss, you're bleeding. Well, if you've been involved in a car accident or, you know, some sort of serious, injury, it's pretty obvious where the blood's going. But if, on the other hand, you have a bleeding ulcer, something in the GI tract, and you're losing blood, it isn't going to be evident necessarily. It is not immediately apparent what's going on. One of the things that we do see, and I alluded to that, was that we'll have a reticulocyte count go up pretty quickly, not instantly, but pretty quickly. Remember, all the other cells are lasting for a relatively long period of time, so it takes a little time for the kidney to sort this all out. The kidney, remember, is really this is the fulcrum point in terms of red cell production. Now, obviously, you have to have a healthy bone marrow. You have to have the precursors. Why have I brought the kidney into this? All right, it produces the EPO, produces the stimulus, the hormonal stimulus to the bone marrow. And let me tell you, people who have kidney failure will have terrible anemia. They will be dying sick with anemia, even though the bone marrow is perfectly healthy, because there is no erythropoietin to stimulate red cell production. And this is a very common problem with people who have kidney failure on the basis of diabetes, the most common form that we have here in the United States. They all have serious anemias, and today we give them injections. We can make the EPO, and basically put the gene into a yeast, the yeast cranks it out, we harvest the EPO and inject it into people. And it makes a big difference in their lives. It makes a difference whether they die or not. So, but one of the things that we're looking for here, if the kidneys are functioning and they can produce, they recognize that you don't have enough red cells, they're going to release the erythropoietin, it's going to stimulate the bone marrow, and of course it's going to start flooding the system with new young cells, stimulating more production, and we're going to be looking for an increased number of reticulocytes. Again, the reticulocytes are the young cells. They're out there for 2 or 3 days with a much greater content of RNA than mature cells, and so we can spot them if we do a stain for RNA, we can tell it. And so we're looking to see, and it may raise quite a bit. I said normally it's around 2% or so, but look here, it can go up to 10 to 15%. It doesn't do it instantly, but it can go quite a bit up there. So an acute anemia is something that's happening right now. We're using the term acute and chronic in the temporal sense, as opposed to when we use it in, say, inflammatory cells. You know, we talk about acute inflammatory cells or chronic inflammatory cells, righto? Acute inflammatory cells being granulocytes and chronic lymphocytes. So we use this term, we use these terms kind of differently depending on what system we're talking about. In the case of anemias, acute really means just that. It came very suddenly. Chronic anemias, we have quite a bit of time to adapt to it. It's amazing a person who is bleeding, say, from a colon cancer and has a very small amount of blood loss every day. In time, they use up all their iron stores. So colon cancer may take as long as 3 to 4 years before it becomes evident. It isn't something that grows so quickly that it becomes evident in a week or two. It may be there years. All right, if you're losing just a tiny bit of blood every day, it may not appear in the stool because it's just not enough. It gets mixed in with the poop and you simply don't see it. Unless it's right there at the anal sphincter, which you might see bright red blood. But otherwise, if it's somewhere else in the colon, you can lose a lot of blood over a very long period of time. We're talking 3 or 4 years here. And in that case, you can deplete your iron stores, and a person in my age group might come in with an iron deficiency anemia, and the cause for me is completely different than it is for one of you. If you guys came in with it, it's probably your crappy diet. Alrighty. If I come in with an iron deficiency anemia, it's because I'm probably losing it very slowly. People who have that can adapt to extraordinarily low hemoglobin levels. What is the normal? Do you know what the normal hemoglobin level is in the blood? We express it in grams per cent, grams per 100 cc's. Yeah, it's about 13.5 to 15.5, depending on sex and degree of activity and so forth and pulmonary status. So it's around 15 grams per 100 cc's. People can actually get down to like 3 and 4. Amazingly, they can't do much. If they stand up, they're going to pass out. They're typically brought in. They have absolutely no stamina, and they look like hell. They look like a cadaver, but they're still alive because they got just enough hemoglobin to sort of keep the fires burning as long as they don't do anything. So you can adapt to the most extraordinarily low. You couldn't possibly do that up here. You lose 50% of your blood supply right now because of an auto accident. I got news for you, friends. Your genes are coming out of the gene pool. That's the end of it. You lose half of your blood supply acutely, you're done for. You can, over a period of months or years, lose an extraordinary amount of it and still adapt very slowly. So we make a distinction then between suddenly occurring situations and those that have taken a long time to evolve or develop. When we work up a person, we evaluate a person for anemia. Again, what we're looking at would be a variety of things, age being very important, as I mentioned. The underlying cause for an iron deficiency anemia for someone like me is completely different than, say, for someone in your age group. Sex, medications, overall duration, things like that. Sex is an important thing because women obviously are losing blood during at least reproductive times every month. You lose a little bit. Some women have extremely heavy menstrual cycles, and you can lose a lot of blood. You're sort of right on a brink all the time of having adequate iron intake based on what you're losing monthly. Of course, that doesn't happen for men. What kind of medications are you taking? Could you be even competing? Could you impede iron absorption or folic acid? Are there other medications or other conditions that you have, like Crohn's disease, inflammatory condition of the bowel that changes your ability maybe to absorb B12? So there are a variety of things that we want to know about. As I mentioned, things that we look for externally would be evidence of paleness in places that we can see. Your skin is not really a good indicator because it takes so much, such a decrease in hemoglobin before you become pale. You can certainly do it, of course, but it's much easier to see it in the conjunctiva and mucous membranes and nail beds. Some of the things that we look at here, and I'm not going to go into great depth on these indications, just a couple I will mention. And when we take a look at the complete blood count, of course we'd like to know how much hemoglobin is out there. We also would like to know what's the hematocrit. When we talk about hemoglobin, we're talking about grams of hemoglobin per 100 cc's of blood, of course all of which are in red blood cells. What is a hematocrit? What is that? Yeah, right, and you probably have done that. Prick your finger, you put in a little tube, you spin it, you see it, and you got about 40% of the, and everything settles, the heavy objects are going to settle on a basis of centrifugation, and then you have about 45%, 40% red blood cells, or at least packed cellular elements, and the rest of it is fluid. So we look for hematocrit, amount of hemoglobin. We will also look for a very important thing is to look for the size of the cell. This MCV stands for mean corpuscular volume. Are the cells real tiny? Are the cells too large? There is an optimal range of size for those cells, and depending on whether they're too large or too small, it tells us something about either nutritional deficiency or how rapidly cells are being produced, or are they being fragmented and beat up. So MCV, mean corpuscular volume, is very important. We also look at what's called the RDW. That's red cell distribution width. RDW, red cell distribution width. Now, if we got everybody in here and lined them up, we would see that there is basically a range in size from tall people to shorter people, but there's basically a predictable kind of a distribution. One of my kids was in Cub Scouts, and they were over at our house one time building bird houses. And God, I mean, it can be noisy if you've ever been with it, you know, and you have a whole troop of these guys, and then of course they're all jazzed up on sugar, and I had had it. I had a little workshop, and we were out in the back. We were doing it. And finally, I just couldn't deal with the racket and the crap anymore. And I said, "How about everybody to go out in the yard right now and line up alphabetically according to height?" You know, they did it. Amazingly enough, they did it. They went out, and the first thing that they did was they lined up alphabetically. They lined up whose last name was A, B, whatever it was, and then with each category, they arranged themselves according to who was the tallest and who was the shortest. And it didn't take but about 3 minutes, so that didn't help me at all. Well, the RDW is a little bit like that. What we want to see is, do we have an expected distribution of red cell sizes? Because a young cell is large and an old cell is small. And if we see a huge range in this thing, we know something is going on. Cells are probably being beat up. A lot of new cells are coming in. We don't always know what it means, but it means there's something going on in terms of red cell survival in all likelihood. As I mentioned, we look for reticulocyte count. I want to know how many red cells, new red cells, are coming into the scene. If it turns out it's none, or a very small number, in the face of an anemia, you'd expect the bone marrow to kind of, hey, let's get with it here. So it can mean a couple of things. A low reticulocyte count could mean kidney disease, and we got no erythropoietin being elaborated. It could mean that we have a nutritional deficiency. Maybe there's not enough iron. So there are a variety of things that could come to bear. Maybe there's bone marrow disease. The bone marrow itself is sick or been scarred, and there is inability to produce it. If we're really just pouring these things out hand over fist, and we're still anemic, well then where are they going? Where are the mature cells going? Are we bleeding? Are they losing, being lost in that way? Or are they being destroyed? Is there an autoimmune destruction? We can look specifically for certain vitamins, do a bone marrow, and then fancy stuff that would include such things as hemoglobin, looking at hemoglobin lactophoresis in the case of someone who has sickle cell disease, although there are very quick ways to determine that without needing to do a apheresis. But at any rate, there are other things that we can do beyond just this standard stuff here. Bone marrow is really the thing of last resort as a rule. Most anemias can be figured out long before we get to that phase. And again, fancy stuff really does apply to looking at quantities of particular species of hemoglobin within a red cell, because we're all just not so-called A2 hemoglobins. We all have some, or A1 hemoglobin rather. We all have some mixture of things. All right, let's just take a look here what we mean by when we take a look at individual erythrocytes then. We look at their size. Is there variation in the size? That's anisocytosis. And that says that there's simply too much variation. We should have a somewhat tighter population. We expect the average person, the average height of people to run somewhere from around 6'4" to maybe, 5'4", something like that. That's about the average. And when you have somebody who's 7 foot or someone who's 3 feet, they may still be perfectly normal and they just represent something that's way out there, but who knows. Same thing with this. The shape, poikilocytosis, are they odd shaped? Are these cells beat up? Are they fragmented? Do they have bites taken out of them? That sort of business. Again, when we take a look at hemoglobin content, we're looking at how much hemoglobin is in each red blood cell. These right here stand for hemoglobin concentration and percentages, and we can say that, you've got some red cells, but by God, they are very peaked. They really don't have the quantity of hemoglobin they should have. And again, maybe that's due to a nutritional deficiency of some kind. I mentioned the mean corpuscular volume, which is the size, and by extension then the RDW. Do we see things in there? Are there little inclusions, or are there is the hemoglobin precipitated in some way, or is there an abnormality in the shape or size shape of the cell, very dramatic and reproducible, as in the case of sickle cell disease. So there are some things that we get just from taking a look at the red cells on the peripheral blood smear. When we think about etiologies, then, I mean, that's really where we need to go. We've got to figure out how come the person became anemic in the first place, because that's really where is the point of attack. We're just not going to, say, infuse them with red cells or give them iron when there's no reason to, because it may not change anything. So if we're taking a look at acute blood loss, well, again, we're back to, is there visible blood? And if not, could they be losing it into the GI tract, and we just don't see it there? So there are various ways, however, for assessing for that. Obviously, getting a history regarding, menstrual flow, nutritional history, and things of that kind. So we come around then to using terms such as RBCs are normocytic. And that is to say they look appropriate. If we're looking at an acute anemia, say from blood loss, the red cells that are still there are basically going to look normal. They're just not there in adequate numbers. So normocytic means they look right, they got the right amount of hemoglobin. They're basically normal red cells, it's just that we don't have enough. Now, could that be a problem with the bone marrow itself? So the reticulocyte count will help. If the reticulocyte count has gone up again, you know the bone marrow is kicking these suckers out, but they're going someplace. So hinging on a lot hinges around that reticulocyte count. Let's take a look at specific examples now of hemoglobinopathies and so on. Congenital anemias are relatively uncommon, and often there's a reason for them to be there. And that is to say there's some evolutionary pressure, sickle cell diseases in the population, thanks to malaria. We understand how that works and so forth. And in malaria-prone areas, wherever you go, Central Africa, Equatorial Africa, India, China, all the way around the globe, with the exception of the New World, where we did not have malaria until colonization period. Wherever it is, we have some variety of sickling hemoglobin, and it's not all S. It's S and C and so forth in particular strains or variants of that beta chain. In Africa, it's E and O, and they're all different. As we go into the Orient and then India and then into the Orient, and they all have, wherever there was malaria, we have sickle hemoglobins. And it conferred a survivability, the heterozygote phase did. Well, here's an example of a sickled cell. And again, we can take a look. We can do a very quick test to see if we can trigger that. In the laboratory, it's cheap. We can see if they're a person who has one gene or both genes, although if they're homozygous for it, they're typically very sick right from the get-go. another is enzyme deficiency, such as G6PD. And most times, we don't know about that until the person is stressed, has oxidative stress. G6PD is involved as an enzyme, involved, as you might know, in recharging glutathione. Glutathione, intracellularly, is the principal thing that sucks up free radicals. It sucks up these oxidative, these kind of high-energy electrons. And it sucks it up by causing a cross-linking of sulfhydryl groups in the protein. And then what you have to do is open those sulfhydryl groups up again. You kind of step that electron down. You can then slowly bring it down and release its energy so that it doesn't do membrane damage or something like that. A G6PD person, deficiency person, does not have an adequate ability to recharge that glutathione, so even little bits of oxidative injury, often that come about from uses of antibiotics or high blood pressure medicine, is sufficient to do this, or just becoming sick, dehydrated, and so forth, will lead to inability to be able to manage just the native occurring oxidative products, the high energy electrons that occur in all of us all the time. So, and then what we will see is red blood cells with membrane damage, and they rupture, and the red cells have a much, much shorter lifespan, and the bone marrow just about cannot keep up with it. There are interesting membrane problems in which the membrane is not flexible. Red cells have to be able to negotiate some pretty tight corners, particularly in the capillaries and so forth. They have to be able to sort of squeeze and change their position, change their shapes a little bit, and then spring back into their shape. And if you have very rigid membranes, it can't do that, and little bits and pieces of the membrane start breaking off. Well, the spleen is the fellow that is looking at how old are red cells, and it's going to say, when do we have to take a red cell out of circulation? And what it's looking for will be small, stiff red cells. And it says that cell must be 120 days old, because all of them, in time, all of our red cells are subject to oxidative injury. They lose membrane bits and pieces here and there in the healthiest of states. And so what's happening then is that the spleen is looking for little, small cells that can't really negotiate tight turns in the spleen itself, and it says that must be an old cell. It pulls it out of circulation, destroys it. On a red cell, someone who has an inherited condition that involves some of those membrane proteins that are no longer functioning as they should, the membrane can't spring back into position. It looks like it's an old cell when it's really a very young cell right off. And so it's taken out of circulation, and the bone marrow tries to keep up with this to produce more red cells, but it simply cannot keep up with the premature loss of them. And in that case, the red cells are being destroyed in the normal pathway. It just happens to be that the process is occurring a lot earlier in the lifespan of the red cell. Well, let's take a look at some specifics here. There's sickle cell anemia again. And again, there are a variety of things. It's almost always someplace in that distal portion of the beta chain. This is the classic example here, the beta 6 position that leads to the sickling hemoglobins. When they become deoxygenated, then they crystallize. They basically link up and they deform that. The red cell ruptures. The other thing that happens is that the red cells will stick in the capillaries because they're now this long, rigid, spiky thing with crystalline hemoglobin in it, which of course is not doing for a crap in terms of absorbing oxygen and releasing oxygen. But also, since they're so misshapen, they will actually occlude the blood vessels. And one of the first things that will happen in the case of a kid with sickling, who's homozygous for sickle cell disease is that they will basically infarct their spleen in little bits and pieces. They'll lose a little bit of it today, a little bit of it tomorrow, because the red cells, when they're trying to negotiate the tight corners in the splenic sinusoids, they'll get stuck in there, because as they become deoxygenated, it crystallizes, misshapes, you know, develops these misshapen sickle cells, and they stick there. And because they're all stuck in there, then they retard blood flow, and little bits and pieces of the spleen die every day. Now, the problem with that is that in order for you to develop appropriate immunity, particularly against very nasty microbes such as encapsulated meningococcus and encapsulated streptococcus, you've got to have a functioning spleen. And so when we know a kid has sickle cell disease, as opposed to sickle cell trait, which is to say they're heterozygotes, when they're homozygous for that, we get on them immediately in terms of immunizing them against all those kinds of bugs that we know are going to be real problems for them later in life. Because by the time they're 6 or 7, the spleen is gone, and the doc has missed the chance. We're never going to get them adequately immunized. I hope everybody in here got a meningococcal vaccine before you went to college or something. Maybe even a booster shot of that thing. Very important. Well, in the case of a kid with sickle cell disease, if we don't get to them by 6 or 7, it doesn't matter very much what we do after that. We're not going to be very successful at getting them to develop immunity to those really dangerous bacteria. The precise reason for that, I don't understand, but I do know that if you lose your spleen, you infarct it away in little bits and pieces every day, by the time it's gone or it's removed because of injury or trauma, there's going to be problems in terms of getting you to develop the immunity to those kinds of bacteria. So sickle cell disease has a lot of problems not only in terms of oxygen carrying capacity and having red cells that rupture prematurely. There are other things that affect somebody with that. They have all kinds of problems eventually with kidney function because, again, of sickling within those little vessels in the kidney. So there are many problems just beyond the obvious thing of the anemia. with sickle cell disease. The sickle cell trait, on the other hand, the heterozygote state for that, you rarely have anything unless you really are hypoxic. And but the heterozygote state confers the relative, I wouldn't say immunity to malaria, but it makes the malaria infection much less severe. There are a number of NFL football players who cannot play can't play football when they go to, in fact, some of them don't even make the trip to Denver. Do you know that? A lot of guys who play football for professional NFL players who play football for, let's say, Baltimore and other places around there, if they are heterozygotes, they often don't even make the trip. They're not going to go there where they may become hypoxic, and they're certainly not going to go out and run around on the football field where they're absolutely going to become hypoxic at 5,200 feet elevation. We can count on that's going to happen. So many times they don't even make the trip if they know they're heterozygous. They don't even go. And that's just a preventive measure, and it's the way it has to be. So, but on the other hand, if there's ever an issue with malaria, they're the ones that are going to make it, and their genes are going on, and mine are not. Okay, I've already done what I can do for that. But all right, at any rate, so there are interesting cultural and sort of social ramifications of this, to say nothing of providing care for at least the people who are homozygous for that early on, when you recognize that, or there's going to be a world of hurt, world of problems later in areas you may not anticipate. Let me just, before we take our break, I'm going to finish up just this on, and we'll pick up on thalassemias when we come back. I mentioned the idea of cells that become rigid, and this is what's going on really to a degree just about in all of us all the time. There's oxidative injury to every cell in our body because we generate these free radicals. We generate these high energy electrons normally, and we've got a system internally of neutering them. And most of that, again, is glutathione. We allow that high energy electron to cause a crosslink in the sulfhydryl groups in glutathione, and then we have an enzyme, G6PD, opens it up and steps down that high energy electron. So all of our cells, to some degree, maybe minus lots of little pieces like this, are getting rigid over time and smaller, and that's how the spleen determines that this is an old cell that's ready to bring it out of circulation and we'll replace it with a young cell. Now, if you cannot, if there's a problem with the ability of a red cell to be able to negotiate these tight turns and it can't really twist and conform, and come back into its native shape, you're going to start pinching off and breaking little pieces of the cell all the time. And there are several proteins that live right beneath the membrane. So here's the upper membrane, transmembrane proteins, and these are some of these anchorin and spectrin molecules that are right below. They're kind of the springy quality, the rubber bands in there that say when the red cell has to get through here and it's got to bend one way, it's going to accordion up some of its membrane on one side. It sort of bends. Some of it's going to stretch. On the other side, it's going to kind of accordion up a little bit, like the doors on closets that sort of squeeze together. There's a guy who I remember had an accordion, and he was an accordion player in a group, and he'd just done a gig and he was on his way home. And he'd gone into a bar, he'd parked his car in his parking lot there, and he went in, and I thought, oh my God, my accordion is sitting in the back seat of the car. Anybody can see it right through the window. And he ran out, but he was too late. Someone had broken out the window and left two more accordions. Well, at any rate, when the cell has to bend and twist, part of the membrane has to accommodate by kind of making that sort of accordion fold. And if you can't spring it back into position, if these rubber bands aren't there to allow it to sort of spring back into position, little bits and pieces are going to pinch off. The membrane is rigid. The membrane prematurely, the whole cell becomes prematurely smaller. When you have severe cytosis, well, the cells are themselves, they really don't have the biconcave appearance that we normally would look for. But at any rate, somewhere about here, which is at about maybe 1/2 to 2/3 of the lifespan of the cell, the spleen thinks, oh my God, it's an old cell, and it's taken out of circulation and destroyed. So sometimes genetic things such as that are going to lead to chronic anemias, ongoing anemias, because the cells themselves appear to be older than they are. Okay, we're going to take our break now. I'll see you on the hour, please. We'll talk about hemolytic anemias, I don't know where the dickens the thalassemias went. Come back. Well, okay. All right, I will see you in a bit. I don't.